Welcome to SoFlow by Lucas Millar. Lucas's latest collection of 13 short stories, ranging from the gross and silly to heart-wrenching thrillers of cosmic proportions. Join Lucas as he takes you beyond the beaches and shows you the dark side of the Sunshine State. Welcome to SoFlow, a collection of weird Florida horror by Lucas Millar. Available January 14th, 2024. Brought to you by the Evil Cookie Publishing. Welcome to another episode of Dead Headspace. I'm your host, Patrick R. McDonough, joined always by my friend Brian LaFaro. Say hello, Brennan.
Hello, everybody.
And our other friend, Candace Nola. Say hello, Candace.
Hello.
And today we are joined from a returning guest, Wob Gishig Rice. Say hello, Wob.
Hey, Patrick, Brennan, and Candace. Great to be with you all today.
When you were, the first time you were on was season 2, episode 81. We're on episode 237. It's only been 2 years. So what's happened, man, from then? I know you got a new beautiful son.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, a new book. But is there anything in particular you would like to discuss?
Just, wow, the passage of time is worth discussing for sure. You know, what a trip to consider how long it's been and what's all gone on in all of our lives since then, right? But I think that's a really cool opportunity just to, you know, be thankful for everything in our lives when we look back in those, you know, chunks of time. And since then, as you mentioned, a new little boy, a new book that just came out, and I'm just grateful for the journey ongoing.
How's it feel? Because I don't even know if you were, I don't remember you mentioning even the idea of a sequel. I could be wrong. It's been a couple of years, but I don't recall you talking about it at all. When did the idea come to you?
Yeah, if we did talk about it, it probably would have only been in passing. The idea or the opportunity first came up in late 2019, but it wasn't a sure thing until early to mid 2020 is when I had an offer to get it done. And I think if, you know, at that point when we talked, I was probably underway, but like, you know, just in the early developmental phase, right? And you all know as creators, when those things are just forming, you don't want to reveal too much or discuss too much around them for worry of like derailing yourself ultimately, right? The sequel would have been underway when we talked last time, but it definitely was not as fully formed as it could have been to talk about it publicly, you know?
So for those that are unfamiliar with what we're talking about, his first book, Moon of the Crusted Snow, phenomenal book, apocalypse book, told in. And can you please pronounce the tribe name? Because I feel like I'm going to butcher it.
Oh, yeah, no worries. Then the Anishinaabe people, it's part of my heritage. That's my dad's lineage. I grew up in an Anishinaabe community on Georgian Bay, here on the Great Lakes, on the Ontario side. And the Anishinaabe people more or less are around all of the Great Lakes. You know, our region is quite vast on both sides of the border between what's now Canada and the United States. And I proudly represent our people and our stories, and just very grateful for the opportunity to write about our experiences.
Now, with Moon of the Crusted Snow, I forget what it's called, but there is something in Canada. I know other parts of like Europe, I don't know where else in the world where you can apply for something with the government to basically fund the finances on the book. Is that what you, didn't you do that with the first one?
Oh yeah. You know, ever since I explored becoming an author, grants were a big part of it. And I think up here in Canada and yeah, in a lot of European countries too, you know, there are strong public arts funding initiatives like granting programs, both from the federal government and from provincial governments. And you know, it's not a huge amount of money. Like, it's not like you're gonna, be set for years to write a book, but it's enough to like allow you to focus on writing for a few months at a time, to maybe take a leave from your day job and just be a full-time author. And I really had fortunate opportunities to do that while I was working as a journalist for the CBC. But 4 years ago, I made the leap into full-time writing, and yeah, grants were a part of that too. You know, that enabled and empowered me to, yeah, focus on Moon of the Turning Leaves entirely for, all up until it got published.
It's so cool, man. I don't think that's a thing in the States.
Yeah, you know, I've talked to some American colleagues, and there are some arts funding initiatives, but you know, they're, from what I've heard, they're more geared towards authors in like mid to later stages of their careers, I guess. Whereas up here, you know, if you're an emerging writer, you can apply for a grant, and that money is earmarked directly for that, right?
Wow.
It's hoping to get people kickstarted into the industry. So I do know there are programs down there, but not as extensive as up here for sure.
That's pretty cool. I just want to throw this out there. If you look up for anyone else that's interested in Wub Geeshig's this or the previous episode with us, you got a lot of interviews. I mean, when you were a journalist, but even now as an author specifically, there's one really neat one with the Toronto Public Library. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what it means to just like, because for me, like as a kid, like my dream would be to have like my books and whatnot in the Boston area, because that I'm from Massachusetts, so like that would be a big deal for me. For you is Toronto, I know, is your everything. That's your Mecca.
Yeah.
And I want to know how it feels that like you can bring your kids to the library and be like, Dad's got some books there. How does that feel, man?
It's so special, you know. It's a dream come true. And also a dream that, you know, probably would have seemed well beyond reach when I was much younger, you know. So to have opportunities to be on shelves is just the coolest thing. And then to have my kids, who are now old enough to be aware of, you know, tangible books and who's written them and what they're about, and then having their dad, you know, have his face and name on books that are easily accessible is pretty awesome. So, yeah, and you know, that Toronto Public Library event last fall was super cool. You know, Toronto is the biggest city closest to us. It's where I went to university back in the day. And you know, it really is the hub of, you know, the literary world here in Canada for sure, right? And the Toronto Public Library, that branch, the downtown one, is just, you know, a foundational sort of mecca, as you said, right? For the literary arts. So to have an
And
event there,
film.
yeah, and film too, yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. So yeah, it was super cool to be able to do that.
Right on, man. I've hogged enough air time. Why don't we go to you, Kansas?
Okay, so why don't we talk a little bit about the storyline? And since this is actually on part two of it, could you actually talk about the first part real quick and then give us a little bit about what part two is about for anyone that may or may not have read part one before we talk about part two?
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, it's great to have you here, Candace. A new
Thank
patron
you.
the last time I was here, right? So this is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the first book, Moon of the Crested Snow, it's about a small remote Anishinaabe reserve in Northern Ontario that endures a mysterious blackout. You know, suddenly cell phones go out, electricity goes out, they're cut off from the world to the south. And this community is difficult to access. You know, most of the time people fly into it, but there's also some service roads that people can use to get up there. And it's a few hundred kilometers north of the closest city. So because people there, though, you know, live off the land, they're able to hunt and harvest what they need from the natural world around them. Having a blackout isn't an immediate crisis. They're able to sort of adapt and keep themselves warm and fed and so on, right? But, you know, with anybody, as the weeks go on, things would get more tense. And the order starts to unravel slightly as people get a little hungry and want answers and so on. And then all of a sudden, some unexpected visitors come up on snowmobiles from a city to the south. And these are people led by one person initially who are seeking refuge, safety on the reservation in the midst of this crisis. And that sort of upsets the balance in this community. And then the people there are forced to make some tough decisions about, welcoming these people in, what to do about them and their future. And it ultimately becomes a story of renewal because this blackout, is a blessing in disguise of sorts. It's an opportunity for these indigenous people to get back to the land and sort of hit the reset button, right? So these things unfold, and then it comes to, a big sort of conflict. And without giving too much away, towards the end, they create a newer settlement for themselves away from the reserve site, right? So part two picks up 10 years after they moved to this new settlement. And they've been in this place for so long that they recognize a lot of the natural resources around them are starting to dwindle. They're not able to harvest as much food from the land. And they recognize that traditionally their ancestors would have been migratory. They would have traveled from place to place to hunt and fish and gather from the bush and so on. So they decide that maybe it's time to finally move on, to allow the land to replenish itself and also to seek out the world to the south to see if in fact it has ended, to see who's survived and so on. And also, it's explained in the first book that this community was originally displaced from the Great Lakes to far northern Ontario. And part of this quest is to see if they can return to their original homelands down on the Great Lakes there. So, yeah, the first book is about a moment of crisis and the struggle between good and evil in the immediate aftermath. And the second book is more or less a quest story, to explore the world as it's sort of rebuilding itself and the place of all people in a renewed world.
Nice. So, here's another one that I like to ask a lot. So, was there a part of this that you found be more of a struggle to write compared to either part one or the rest of the actual storyline?
As mentioned, like I see the first story, Moon of the Crested Snow, as a pretty straightforward one, right? Like that struggle between good and evil, as I mentioned. And the second one, because it's set farther into the future, it was more of a speculative story. And I did have to sort of imagine the world then, what would happen to towns and cities, after the collapse, a decade plus into the future. But more of a challenge was considering, I guess the how moral lines are blurred after survival becomes the ultimate goal for all people, no matter who they are, right? So that was a little more interesting to sort of explore and to really boil down. But I think the toughest thing overall was I was like, okay, this is going to be a quest story. They're going to walk through the bush for a summer. How interesting is it to follow people as they walk through the bush, until they encounter other people, right? So that was the biggest challenge, is like upping the tension as they're mysteriously traversing this landscape, right? So but I had a great editor who really helped me pump up those parts, and in the end, I was satisfied with how the end result ultimately.
So one more before I kick it over to one of my fellow co-hosts, and I like this one a lot because I know who I would pick. But do you have a favorite character in this part of the book?
Yeah, for Moon of the Turning Leaves, it's definitely Nungos, the daughter.
She's
So
badass.
yeah, I like her.
Right
Okay.
yeah, she was super fun to write. When I started dreaming up part two, Evan, the dad, the main character in part one was gonna be there again. And because he was older and the kids were older, I thought, yeah, I want one of the kids to be part of this quest. And I think, the trope more commonly is to have the son be part of the quest, you know, make it like a father-son buddy adventure story. But that didn't really interest me at all because that story's been done so much, right? And you know, I felt like if I did it that way, I'd potentially alienate a lot of women, you know. And I felt it was my responsibility to try to create a strong female lead character. So that really was the motivation behind making Nungos one of the core characters, right? And yeah, it's really tough, you know, being a man in your 40s and writing from the perspective of a 15-year-old girl. But thankfully, you know, I got a lot of nieces and younger cousins who, you know, I'm in touch with a lot, and I understand what their objectives are for their lives and how they view the world and what's important to them and so on. So I was able really to mold Nungos from all those different experiences of people who I know. And yeah, it was just exciting to have her lead the way as they went on this journey of discovery.
Yeah, I really liked her a lot, and I feel
Thanks.
like you were like spot on with her.
Oh, thanks. Right on.
Just yeah, because I knew I think I maybe within the first chapter where she was kind of like a main part of it, I was like, that's the girl that I'm gonna follow through this story because she, yeah, I liked her a lot. So,
Cool.
Brennan, anyone over there before I continue?
Well, I will jump in with pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of the Moon of the Crusted Snow, when we had talked last time, one of my favorite aspects of it is the isolation, the way that you told an apocalyptic story without telling about the apocalypse, if you will. And I wonder if now that, you know, you've written Moon of the Turning Leaves, where by necessity we're kind of expanding that world, what kind of considerations you put into that with, you know, the pressure, I suppose, of having to explain more versus just be an observer.
Oh, that was a big part of the research and development for sure. You know, I purposely left out the cause of the blackout in the first one because that was intriguing to me. I enjoy post-apocalyptic stories that don't reveal what the cause of the end of the world is. You know, it's fun to imagine what it could be on your own as a reader, I think, right? And I wanted to offer something similar in Moon of the Crested Snow. So I always knew what the cause of the blackout was in Moon of the Crested Snow, but I didn't tell anybody about it. Didn't tell my editor, I didn't even tell my wife, you know, because I felt like if I mentioned this somehow, it's going to get out there, and then that's going to sort of taint people's imagination of the story and of what the cause of the blackout could be. And then when the time came to work on the second book, I thought, you know, if people read a whole other novel and still don't know what the cause is or what any of the answers are, they're going to be pretty pissed off at me, you know? So I was like, okay, I gotta reveal, you know, what I think the cause of this blackout is. But I wanted to show it more as like a domino effect, you know, and as you read Moon of the Turning Leaves, you see that there are a few things that happen after the power goes out, like sickness and nuclear meltdowns and stuff like that, right? And just the general chaos of the collapses of society, you know. So at the same time, I thought because these main characters have been so isolated, they're coming in way after the fact. And they're really not getting many firsthand accounts of what happened in the end of the world, and they're sort of unsure what's true and what isn't, right? They're trying to piece everything together, and I think that's, you know, realistic, for lack of a better word. You know, if you were isolated for that long and you endured the end of the world and you didn't know what happened, you'd be forced to pick up the pieces and try to imagine, you know, the whole outcome of that moment, right? So that was fun to do, but it also required like a little bit of scientific research. And you know, for your listeners who haven't read Moon of the Turning Leaves yet, I won't reveal what the cause is, but you know, once you've read it, you'll know that like you have to sort of have an understanding of how that kind of phenomenon can knock out, you know, power infrastructure, telecommunications infrastructure, everything else like that, right? So I had to wrap my head around that before fully committing to it for sure.
And I think, as we are typically a podcast that delves into the horror side of things, I think that it's such a component of the genre, or at least the characteristics of the genre, to make those discoveries, to have the characters make those discoveries and hear stories that lead them to conclusions, and then hear stories from other sources that don't quite jive with the, basically that we're hearing essentially these contrasting ideas that really just make the world a bigger, lonelier, scarier place with no definitive answer, at least at certain stages of the journey. And you mentioned kind of the making it feel real, the authenticity of it, and I think that was a great way to go about it, was to
Oh, thank
almost
you.
seed that, not disinformation, but confusion almost. All right, so I am looking at the spine of this, and there is a blurb from one of our favorite humans, Amakatsu, and it says, "Let's hope Wapgeisha Grice doesn't make us wait too long for the next visit to this captivating world."
Oh,
So I'm wondering if Alma knows something that we don't, Alma knows something that you don't.
maybe she knows something I don't know. I don't know. What a blessing to have an endorsement from her. I was so surprised when the my editor let me know about that. But I don't want to rule out a part three because I originally ruled out a part two when the first part was coming out. I had no intention of writing a sequel at all, right? And it was due entirely to the enthusiasm of readers that I really took it seriously and started to explore it, right? So I have like a really vague idea of what a part three could be, but I kind of want to give it a little time before, diving right into it. And there's some other like more lighthearted things I want to try to write first. And I know fans of your podcast, it wouldn't be in their wheelhouse whatsoever, I don't think. But I need sort of a break from this, post-apocalyptic world I've had my head in for almost the last decade, So, but yeah, just having people in, so keen on this world and these characters is really the greatest privilege and the greatest honor I could ever have as a storyteller, So I feel like I owe those people another glimpse into the world if they want it. And yeah, it's up to me to work hard to try to give them something worthwhile, So, in a few years' time, I'm definitely gonna see if I can develop something for sure.
Very cool. Yeah, and that was something you kind of touched on it there, but one of the initial questions that Patrick had launched at you was, when work began in earnest on this. And you have this line right up the top at the acknowledgments that basically says that the fans of the first book made this one happen. And I do wonder, like, how much of a factor was that? Did you say you kind of got the gears turning for a potential book three if the response is right, but with book one going into book two, was that entirely response? Were you thinking and you just weren't sure whether it was a viable option? How did that go about?
Yeah, it's interesting, to look back on that because I was working full time as a journalist and, just having these passion projects of writing fiction, in my spare time, right? And just so fortunate that I was able to get this book done and get it published. Moon of the Crested Snow, I mean, right? While I was working full time. And I put like all of my creative energy into it, after work or on the weekends or whatever else. And I just thought I totally tapped out the tank with that story. I didn't really see beyond the ending of it because I thought this is all I'm able to commit to this, and I'm happy with it. I'm happy with how the story ends. If readers want to imagine what they're doing when they go off into this other place, and that's cool. That's my gift to the readers, and their reception of it is their gift to me at the same time. But when I started taking it out to do like publicity back in 2018 when it came out, people would ask me, hey, this seems like it would make a good series. Have you started working on that? And I would say no, because I was being honest. I wasn't at all. I had not considered a sequel, you know? And then I would notice that people would look really disappointed when I told them that. And I thought, oh man, I gotta like massage the truth a little bit and just give them something, right? So I would start saying like, oh yeah, you know, I'm thinking about it, but not really be thinking about it, right? But I had to really like take a step back and acknowledge that, you know, as mentioned, that these are people so keen on the story and this world and these characters that I owe it to them to try again, to try hard. And also, most importantly, I owe it to the characters in the story. I owe it to that world to give them another opportunity to live in a whole other story, right? And all that combined just felt like such a huge gift, you know? It was just so massive to be able to recognize that and think, wow, you know, there's something alive here. You know, there's something, you know, and I hate to use the term magical because, you know, I don't even know what magic really is, but there's something magical going on with readers and this story that, you know, as the conduit, I owe it to everybody to try again. So that's when it really started, I think, turning up emotionally for me. And I think that was really the key, was just to have my heart and my spirit in it and really think hard about it and just feel blessed to be able to do it, you know?
Ooh, you know, I almost didn't throw out that question because I felt like you had kind of talked about it a little bit, but I'm real glad I did because that's such an interesting point about owing it to readers. Because at the forefront is, you know, it's the art. You got to follow the art, the story that wants to be told. And if you've got something that you're passionate about that you want to do, shouldn't that be the thing that you're working on? But at the same time, these are the readers are the people who are, you know, the reason that you get to do like an event like the one we were talking about at the Toronto Library. They're the ones that have shouted about and, you know, championed the first book. And if you can craft a story that continues on in that world that you are confident in and feels like does justice for those characters, then at least a little bit, you know, don't you owe it to them? That's really interesting. I'm not sure that we've ever had that exact line of conversation before.
Well,
I don't
yeah,
think so.
and you know, it's part of reciprocity, right? Like, you know, as creators, we are part of a relationship, you know. We give and receive. And I think recognizing that it is something we're building, you know, with readers, with our peers as writers, with broadcasters, podcasters, everybody involved in all these discussions. Like, it's important to be as accessible as possible, in my opinion, and to really keep those discussions going because that's what really fuels the storytelling, really fuels the writing, you know? And I've just been nothing but energized by all of it.
Yeah. Again, I'm really glad we went down this route. This is cool. Patrick.
Thanks for digging deeper there, Brennan. Yeah, it was great.
Certainly. Patrick, I'm going to throw it to you.
I'm just wondering for readers, for whatever reason, if they were to just pick up book two, and for people that don't know, can they just enjoy that without knowing anything from the Moon of Crusted Snow?
I think so, you know, and that was one of the reasons for setting it so far into the future. You know, you have a different sort of setting. You have older characters, you have new characters in some ways. You know, the ones who are little kids in the first one are young adults in the second one. And it's written in a way that like the contextual bits about the first story really aren't like beating you over the head at any point. They're sort of written in a way that they're interspersed throughout like the first part of the first act, essentially, when they're getting ready. And as they're walking too, you know, like there are revelations that are happening as they're walking through the bush, and you learn a bit more about book one. So no, you don't have to read the first book. I think it's written as a standalone, and you can, you know, fully follow what's been happening or what has happened. And I think like, I don't think the emotional payoff would be any different if you didn't read the first book, because ultimately, it's more or less the backstory, right? And it's really about what happened and how this community came to be in this place. And the second story really is about advancing the community and really throwing it to the future, which, you know, in some ways was a lot more fun, was a lot more invigorating for me to do as a writer.
That's awesome, man. Did that take a lot of thought? Like, that might be a silly question to ask, but did that take a lot of thought in the sense of I'm gonna do it this way and kind of risk people that really clung to the first one? 'Cause there are, you know, there's some readers that really just are diehards. Yeah, was there other options for book two, I guess is what I'm asking at the format, the direction.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the only other option would have been to pick it up right after the end of book one, to have them, you know, just months later, going on the quest then. Which, you know, could have been a viable story. You know, it could have worked. But it was less interesting to me to just, you know, pick up the same story, you know, establish the same sort of pacing, the same sort of atmosphere. And that's one thing that's really different, I think, about the second one. And you know, readers of the first one who enjoyed like the creepier, more horrific aspects would probably find those things a little more drawn out in the second one, and maybe not as pronounced as they are in the first one, because they're different lengths too. Like, the first one's only about 220 pages, and the second one's 300 plus, right? So there's like a whole additional third of a story there, you know? So there's a lot to tell, a lot to write, you know? And it can be challenging to make a story like that, especially a quest story, as we mentioned, as we covered, where, you know, for the first third of their quest, they're just going through the bush by themselves, you know? So I think that the tone, readers of the first one will find it a little bit different. But hopefully, you know, what I really tried to capture was the same heart of the people and really the same spirit of the landscape too that they try to tap into as they go on this quest. And you know, it's a while before anything really horrific or creepy happens, but you know, for me, I was writing towards those moments as you know, hard signposts and really like I think enjoyable narrative goals when we get to those points where we see some violence or some really scary elements come in, right? So yeah, I would say that that's the biggest difference between the first and second books, but you know, hopefully people will find them a worthwhile read anyways.
Absolutely. I want to dive into the nuts and bolts as a writer. What, and I'm sure it's different for each manuscript, but how much do you typically cut out from the first draft to the final manuscript version?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, because it
Yeah,
was a
I want to
huge
know how much fat you had, because
it was a huge amount.
it's
Yeah. So we were coming up to I say we, my editor Rick and I, we were always in touch, because like he essentially commissioned me to do this, right? Like, I had to pitch him the idea, and I had to explain to him my plan, and we had to develop this sort of writing plan essentially for the story, right? So he knew what the whole story was. He knew what was going to happen and so on. There were no surprises for him in that sense. But when I was writing it out, I spent from January of 2021 to about the end of May 2021 writing the whole first draft. So about 5.5, 6 months. And our target, you know, for a first draft was, you know, 100,000 words max. And it ended up being 123,000, which was like way too long. And I remember emailing him when I was like at about 110, and I said, "Dude, sorry, this is gonna be too long." And he said, "That's okay. We got time to edit it and all that." So yeah, 123 in the first draft, and the final printed version is about 88,000. So yeah, looking at more than 30,000 words.
Holy shit, that's a
Yeah.
did that hurt to cut that much out?
No, it didn't. I was relieved actually to take that much out, to tell you the truth. And a lot of it was like, just, you know, what I was trying to do was just get as much out there as possible, for the sake of being able to cut, like just to trim the fat, so to speak, or weed the garden, or however you want to say it. And the parts that, you know, he suggested cutting were parts that had to go. It was just like, when I talk about the walking through the bush part, like if you read it and you think that's boring now, it was way more boring in the first draft for sure, So yeah, it was just cutting out like those moments of like, unnecessary introspection, really amping up the action and just trying to make it as good a pace as possible, ultimately.
I got you. So obviously you're happy with the end result,
Yeah.
and you should be. You should be proud, man.
Oh,
What's
thanks, bro.
it? Yeah. I honestly forget if the first one is with Harper Collins. Is it?
No, the first one's with ECW Press. That's an
Okay.
independent publisher up here in Canada. So they have distribution in the States, but no standalone edition.
How's it feel to work with Harper Collins for this one?
It was cool. It was a really interesting editorial practice because largely they just took the work that Rick did. Rick is with Penguin Random House up here in Canada, and he, was main contact person. And once my agent got the American deal, their intention was just to, maybe do some tweaking after Rick did his work. And they ultimately didn't do much at all. So it was pretty hands off, for the most part. But I was pretty satisfied with that too, like that there w weren't going to be many changes between the Canadian and American versions. And yeah, just to have it out in the States as its own edition is super cool. I'm really appreciative of that. And yeah, they've been great to work with in terms of like the publicity and just getting it out there and everything.
Yeah, I was gonna ask if there were in the manuscript itself, like different variations of it. How, like you said, there's not many. How many are we talking about? Just like so little, even you might not even pick up on them.
Oh, like they sent me a list of their tweaks, and it was like a couple dozen, maybe at most, and it was just for vernacular adjustments, really. I was expecting like to for them to change all the kilometers to miles and stuff like that, but they didn't do that either. So
I don't
we're
think you should.
Fahrenheit and everything.
You really shouldn't, man, because like that's part of that world, and
Yeah,
you gotta
exactly. Yeah.
trust a reader, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
There was one other thing with the covers. Now, what was your initial reaction with those? Because there's two, they're similar, but
Yeah.
obviously they're not the same.
Yeah, I was pretty open to whatever designs came up. Like with the Canadian one, the designer is Kellyanne Hill. And she really wanted to have some sort of narrative elements on the cover. So you see that on the Canadian version, you see like a forest setting. And you see like these orange markers tied to the trees, and there's the moment in the book where they're following like bush markers, right? That's what that's supposed to be. And there's like a moon in the background, and it looks really cool. The American one, I just said, whatever y'all think works, and they came up with that beautiful image too. So yeah, anything that sort of harkens back to nature and like can, give the reader this atmospheric sense of being in the forest and being on this journey, I think works really well. So it's cool to see both versions side by side, definitely.
And then again, I really can't remember if this was in the first book, but with the second one, when you mix the native tongue with English, I like that. And I like seeing, I'm seeing more of it now. Like Gabino Iglesias is a huge proponent of that, as you should be, because if you're telling the story of whatever, insert whatever person from, whatever walk of life, it's really just, it's whitewashing it, isn't it? If it's just all English. So I really love how you did that, man. Was that, might sound like a silly question again, but was that a hard decision on your part? Did you get any pushback for keeping it, for trying to whitewash it, or was it all pretty easy to, they're just like, yeah, it makes sense.
That's a really good question. It goes back to the first one, to Moon of the Crested Snow. When I brought that manuscript to ECW, to Susan Renouf, who edited that, the very first draft had all the instances of Anishinaabemowin, the language, spoken in dialogue, right? And then the character would repeat it in English right after. And Susan asked me, she said, well, why do you have them doing that? It doesn't make sense and it's not realistic because if you have a person speaking that language to someone who understands it, they're not going to say the same thing in English right away. You know, it's kind of redundant and silly, right? And I said, oh, I know, I just thought I should do that for readers who don't know it. And she's like, no, there's other ways you can do that. You know, you can translate it in the context that follows, or in the action that follows, or in the English dialogue from the other person in conversation that follows, and so on, right? And she said, no, just let your language be there, you know, represent it proudly, you know, be, you know, a proponent of it and let it stand in literature, you know. It's only a few instances in a wider English text, but you know, just let it be itself. And that was like hugely empowering, you know, to have, you know, a white woman in her 60s from the big city of Toronto telling me, this guy originally from the res, that, you know, no, leave your language there, let it be, you know, let everybody else figure it out on their own. I was like, wow, wasn't the response I was expecting at all, right? You know,
That's
when you
awesome, man. Seriously, that's
when you,
great.
yeah, when you take your little res story to the big city, right? You know,
That's so
so
cool.
when it came time to work on the second book with, you know, new editor, new publisher, I told him how Susan and I worked, and he thought that was cool. And there's a lot more of the language in the second one because, you know, it's a longer story, but also, like, you know, my language learning journey continues, right? I learned a bit of it as a kid, but I didn't learn it fluently. And my goal as an adult has been to learn it fluently, right? So in the last few years, I've made quite a few steps ahead. And I wanted to represent that in the story. So there's more conversational dialogue of the language of Anishinaabemowin in the second book. And yeah, there was no real pushback at all from anybody. Sometimes readers will say, you know, I wish you had a glossary in there, or I wish, you know, there's translations and brackets or whatever. And I always say, like, I did not want to do either of those things. I didn't want to put a glossary in because that interrupts the flow of reading, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Someone will be reading and be like, oh, what does that word mean? Let's flip back to the glossary.
Yeah.
And yeah, I wanted to be able to translate it in different literary ways, you know? So there, of course, there are like some pronunciation details people need to know, but I put a video on YouTube to help people with that. So
Oh, that's cool.
yeah, so for your listeners, if you're interested, just Google Moon of the Turning Leaves pronunciation guide, or look in YouTube and you'll find it there.
Nice. And is there, I got one more actually follow up and then Candace, is there different dialects in that tongue, like from say people down in I don't know, Michigan area all the way up to parts of Toronto? There probably are, but like what are they? What's the variations?
Yeah, good question. There are, you know, and I guess it, you know, it's as regional as anywhere else. You know, like people in Massachusetts will talk differently than people in South Carolina, right? Like, there's different. It's not necessarily slang based. It's just slightly different pronunciations, sometimes different words for different things, and so on. But you know, the. I tried to make it as universal as possible. You know, from my community, there's a very specific dialect. But from a community closer to here, closer to Sudbury, it's called Wequemcong. And it's one of the bigger Anishinaabe communities, and their dialect's more widely used, especially in like learning resources. So I tended to lean more on that Wequemcong dialect. But you know, at the core, all the grammar's the same, all the basics, are the same in terms of, like, you know, pronouns, adjectives, or whatever else, right? So yeah, there's universality there that I don't think people would get too lost on if they knew the language and were reading it.
Oh, cool. Candace.
Patrick.
Candace.
Patrick. Okay, so writing itself. Let's talk a little bit about that because isn't that what we all love to
Yeah.
do? How do you write? Do you outline a whole lot? Do you wing it to start with and then kind of start the outline along the way? Like, walk us through what your general process is because I know it probably changes a little bit from like each one, but what do you generally do?
Great question. Yeah, I generally outline. I feel more comfortable if I plan as much out as possible ahead of time. I'll write out just in point form, very basic sort of narrative structure. Obviously going back a bit, it starts with a plot. So if I get the idea, what I'll do is I'll like write the plot in a sentence or two, right? And then I'll sort of leave that for a day or two, and then I'll just walk around and think about it, and I'll keep adding to it until like I feel like I have, maybe a page and a half that's, could serve as like a pitch or a proposal for a novel. And if it feels like there's enough there for a novel, then I'll start building it out a lot more. And I'll write like I'll write it out in scenes basically, right? From the opening to like the rising action to the context to and all the way up to the climax and resolution and so on, right? And that's not to say I totally rigidly stick to that. I allow myself to be flexible if I need to. But before I actually start writing it out, one of the biggest parts of my developmental process is the character profiles. I'll spend a lot of time just writing out who each person is, what they look like, their mannerisms, their various character traits, their relationships with other characters, their likes and dislikes and so on. Because I feel like I really need to know each character as deeply as possible before I sit down to actually write the story out. Because in some ways, the more intimately you know the character, the more they can influence the plot or the writing as you go along. Even though everything's mapped out, you still could get stuck at some point, right? And that's when I like to turn to the characters themselves and think, what would Evan do at this point, or what would Nungos do at this point, or whatever else, So yeah, it's the basic outlining, the character development, and then some research too. That's what I focus on that point. Any other sort of inspiration that I can derive, especially from like my natural surroundings. I do a lot of walking out in the bush, and I spend a lot of time on the water and so on, and I find that really like inspiring, especially for Moon of the Turning Leaves, because it's predominantly an outside story, right? As quest through the landscape and so on. So yeah, it's all planned out, and to sort of go back to the whole writing process of this last one, I've spent probably from May of 2020 to December of that year, doing all of that planning and outlining and so on. And as mentioned, in January 2021 was when I wrote the first draft. So yeah, I had a front load that harder work, I think, and then the writing from there.
Nice. Okay, so which roles? A lot of us have something we have to have when we write, whether it's a snack or a drink or music on in the background or a window open nearby. Do you have any of those that you like absolutely need, or are you just like, I can sit down and write anywhere with anything?
No, there are things I definitely need. It always starts with a walk, After I take my kids to school and daycare, I come back home and then go walk for maybe 50 minutes to half an hour. And yeah, that just helps me, get into, I guess, the mental groove of being ready to sit down for a while and do some writing. And then, when I get back home, I'll maybe listen to a song or two from like a favorite musician. And then sit down to write. And like I don't spend more than like 2 hours writing. I'll get up and do something else, like chores around the house, or e administrative emails or something like that, right? And I think when I get to those points where I'm stuck, I always step away and try to do something else, like play guitar, or maybe watch an episode of something. Or again, like I said, like shoveling snow or doing the dishes or something like that, right? So I think those mundane, like daily tasks are part of my ritual too, because it detaches me from the process, but also grounds me in my home at the same time. And I think my, I guess, just general practices as a human being, So yeah, it is very. There are some very specific things that I do in that self-contained time between like 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. when I drop off my kids and I pick them up again at the end of the day.
So, how about when you reach that all-important moment at the end of the book and you write those last two words, the end? What do you do? Do you have
Oh,
anything? Do you have something that's like, okay, I'm gonna write the end and let me get my drink, let me call everybody in? Like, what do you do when that moment is there? You're like, I'm done.
that's an awesome question. Yeah, like there's like such such a visceral sort of reaction I have to actually like closing the top of the laptop, you know? Like it's an accomplishment to actually do that at that point, you know? You feel it, right? And yeah, I'll turn on some very loud music for sure. Have a drink of something, like probably a beer, you know? And just celebrate, you know? Probably go outside for a walk again too, 'cause you know, I like to bookend the whole process with that, right? So yeah, some very specific things, but yeah, it's so celebratory, right? As you all know, it's a cool feeling.
Nice. Brennan, Patrick, either of you?
I want to jump back to the original question on process, because you did have a very detailed process, especially in comparison to those of us who just fly by the seat of our freaking pants. How, if at all, would you say that your background in journalism ties into your writing process?
Oh, it's big, you know, and I think it's so regimented and so meticulously planned because of my background as a journalist, you know. Every day when I was doing stories for the news, like you have to really finally plan out everything you're gonna do in order to successfully get a story done at the end of the day, right? And you really have to manage time so precisely in order to get that done. So I think that sort of bleeds into working in fiction as well. But I do allow myself the flexibility to take more time or less time here and there, you know. But I think just having that regimented approach to it has, you know, has helped me get it done. But at the same time, I find that I've really, I think, not necessarily confined myself to that process, but maybe have become a little too reliant upon it. And I do want to start, you know, flying up from the seat of my pants, you know, here and there. You know, I do want to, my next story that I want to do, I just want to sit down and write it and see where it goes. Because, you know, it's liberating to be able to do that. And I admire people who can. And I'm excited about the prospect of trying it out, you know, because yeah, it's just like tapping into something that's intangible, something that you know is maybe indescribable too. And it's also a very beautiful thing to just harness whatever is out there and like channel it through your fingertips and then onto the screen, you know, rather than just thinking about every single little detail ahead of time and trying to plan it all out, you know. So yeah, I'm excited to try that out, and you know, I'm sort of like allowing myself to you know, to be flexible in that sense at this point too.
That's cool, man. So, we're gonna start wrapping down with where can people follow you?
I guess I do most of my social media on Instagram, so you can find me there at WAUB. That's at WAUB. Still on Twitter slash X, you know, or whatever it's gonna be called next year. At the same handle at WAUB, and you can find me on Facebook too at WAUB Gijik Rice. Yeah, those are the three ones, and you know, I have a Blue Sky and a Threads account too. I don't use those as much, but yeah, you know, just find me anywhere on social media, reach out. Always happy to chat with anybody who has come across anything that I've done, and I'm just grateful for the opportunity to have connections for sure, you know. And that's why I love staying in touch with y'all, because you know, I see all the exciting things you're up to on social media, and I'm just like, oh. You guys are like living the dream, you know. You get to have these chats all the time, which is super cool.
It's fun. And eventually, sir, you and I hopefully get to work together as editor and
Yeah.
writer. Oh
Yeah,
man.
we yeah, definitely. That
I'm telling you, that would be
that's
my that you're just like all the way up there. So I'm
Oh,
throwing that out
thank
there
you.
live.
Oh,
Well,
thank you,
on
brother.
air. Where can people follow you, Brennan? Sorry, I almost skipped you. I had a brain fart. I was thinking about working with Wob.
That's okay. You are forgiven.
Thank you.
the majority of the social media places at Brendan LaFaro. I will tell you that my social media manager has been skimping lately. They
Is that
probably need to
you?
be fired. It is me.
Candace.
You can follow me on all the social media networks under Candace Nola, or you can follow me under Uncomfortably Dark.
You can follow me at PR McDonough. Follow the show at Dead Headspace. And final thoughts, Wob.
Just, heading into a pretty wild year everywhere in the world. Up here in where we are in Northern Ontario, we've had like our mildest winter with the least snowfall, in a really long time.
Oh,
So,
wow.
those things can be a little bit unsettling, so I don't know. Like, I always just tell people or try to advise people just to, stay close to home, keep your loved ones close, and look out for each other, be kind to each other, and always remember we're in this together in our communities, right? And
Absolutely.
just always appreciate any opportunity to connect with anybody anywhere. And I commend Dead Headspace for bringing communities together. It's a beautiful thing.
Thanks, man. I just felt really lucky to be able to talk to you the first time with Brennan, and it's cool to form a friendship with you because, like, seeing you, like, you're a family man. I love that. I love seeing pictures of your boys and whatnot. Like, I remember you posted recently one of your boys with their braids, and I'm like, that's so cool.
Yeah.
That's really such a talent, man.
No, okay, brother.
Yeah. Final thoughts on, let's go to you, Candace.
Final thought to me. Basically, just thank you for your time here tonight, and the novel, of course, is fantastic. I am gonna read part one. I haven't read it yet. I enjoyed part two, I suppose, even though it is a standalone, but I do want to go back and read part one, because I think after I do that, I'm going to read part two again, and then hopefully you'll be writing part three by then. Hint, hint. And then I can finish the storyline. But
Yeah,
no, just thanks. It was a nice chat, and I think this one is going to do well. So,
thank you. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah, it's one of the more popular episodes. Like, you're up there with Peter Straub and Chuck Palahniuk. You have obviously a pretty cool following too. Brennan, go ahead, sir. Final
I
thoughts.
mean, as always, we're very thankful for your time. Thanks for hanging out with us on a Wednesday night. But I love your little pitch about bringing communities together, because yeah, that's absolutely what the three of us have in mind. And if we can get a hardo horror reader to go out and pick up Moon of the Turning Leaves because they like that idea of that slow burn build toward that, violence. And it's a book that might not have crossed their radar otherwise. Like, hey, that's what we're here for, man. So
Wouldn't.
thanks for hanging out, and we would love to have you back again
Oh,
for whatever you'd like to come on and talk about.
anytime. Yeah, it's just an honor to join you all. Thank you very much.
Same for me. This came in my head, I think, yesterday with after reading a second book by you. Your writing's like a volcano. Like, it's really aesthetically pleasing, but there's pressure building up. And then when it explodes, it's like, oh, Jesus Christ, who the hell's alive after this?
Patrick, your metaphors are like a volcano.
I I'm no Joe Lansdale, but I'll get some point across one day. Yeah, I mean, like, I love that you're back in here to talk with us, and the idea of whatever you write next. I mean, we want you back, buddy. If you've enjoyed this talk, I implore you to seek out his first book, his second one, or your collection. I'm gonna butcher the title. I remember Sweat Lodge, I believe, was in the title, but
Oh yeah, Midnight Sweat Lodge.
that's it. Yep. Yeah, I mean, check that out too. Good writer. And there's plenty more to come. You're still a young man, so next episode is 237. That's with Drew Huff. We're gonna talk about her maybe book, free burn. And as always, you have an interesting podcast. Thank you for joining us.